Letters. Plato to Dionysius, greetings. Having spent so much time with you, and having been entrusted with the administration of your government more than anyone else, while you people reaped the benefits, I put up with the slanders, hard as they were to bear. For I knew that none of the harsher measures would be thought to have been done with my consent. All who shared in your government are witnesses for me, many of whom I fought for and freed from no small penalties. And though I safeguarded your city time and again as a man with full authority, I was sent off with less honor than you owe even a beggar you're dismissing and ordering to sail away, after I had spent so long a time in your company. Well then, from now on I will manage my own affairs in a more guarded, less trusting way, while you, being the kind of tyrant you are, will live alone. As for the fine gold you gave me for my journey home, Bacchus, who carries this letter, is bringing it back to you. It was not enough to cover my travel expenses, nor of any use for the rest of my life, and it would bring the greatest disgrace on you, the giver, and not much less on me if I took it. So I am not taking it. It plainly makes no difference to you whether you give or receive such a sum, so take it back and use it to court some other companion, the way you courted me, for I have been courted quite enough by you already. And here I might fittingly quote Euripides, that if some other trouble should ever befall you, you will wish such a man were standing at your side. I want to remind you too that most of the other tragic poets, when they bring on stage a tyrant dying at someone's hand, make him cry out, "Friendless, wretched, I am dying." But no one has ever shown a man dying for want of gold. And that other verse seems to men of sense not badly put. Bright gold is not the rarest treasure in a mortal's uncertain life, nor adamant, nor silver couches dazzling to the eye when set before men for judging, nor the rich, self-sufficient acres of the broad earth's teeming soil. Nothing is worth so much as the understanding shared among good men. Farewell, and know how far you have fallen short of us in this, so that you may deal better with others in the future. Plato to Dionysius, greetings. I heard from Archedemus that you think not only I, but also my close associates ought to keep quiet and refrain from doing or saying anything ill of you, except that you make Dion the one exception. Now this claim, that Dion alone is exempt, implies that I do not control my own associates. For if I really did control the others, and you, and Dion in this way, there would be more good for all of us and for the rest of the Greeks besides, or so I maintain. But as things stand, my greatness consists in this. I offer myself as someone who follows his own reasoning. And I say this because Cratistolus and Polyxenus have not told you anything sound. One of them, they say, claims to have heard at Olympia a number of people in my company speaking ill of you. Perhaps his hearing is sharper than mine, for I heard nothing of the kind. What you ought to do from now on, it seems to me, is this. Whenever anyone says such a thing about any of us, send me a letter and ask me directly, for I will neither hesitate nor be ashamed to tell you the truth. As for how things actually stand between you and me, they are like this. There is hardly a Greek to whom we are unknown, so to speak, and our association together is no secret. Nor should it escape you that it will not be kept secret in time to come either, since those who have inherited the story are the kind of people they are, given that it was no small or quiet affair. What then am I saying just now? I will explain, starting from the beginning. It is the nature of things that wisdom and great power tend to come together, and that they are forever pursuing each other, seeking each other out, and keeping company. And besides, people take pleasure in discussing such pairs, both talking about them themselves and hearing others do so, both in private gatherings and in poetry. Take, for instance, whenever people talk about Hiero and Pausanias the Spartan, they enjoy bringing up Simonides' company with them, what he did and said in their presence. And they are in the habit of celebrating Periander of Corinth and Thales of Miletus together, and Pericles and Anaxagoras, and again Croesus and Solon as wise men, and Cyrus as a man of power. And imitating this, the poets pair Creon with Tiresias, Polyeidus with Minos, Agamemnon with Nestor and Odysseus and Palames. And, as I see it, the earliest people paired Prometheus with Zeus in much the same way, showing some of these pairs falling into conflict with each other, others into friendship, and others sometimes into friendship and sometimes into conflict, singing of them now in harmony, now at odds. Now I say all this wanting to show one thing, that once we die, the talk about us will not fall silent either, so it is something we must attend to. It seems we are bound by nature to care about the time after us as well, since it happens that the most slavish natures give it no thought at all, while the most decent do everything they can to be well spoken of in later times. And this, I take as evidence that the dead have some perception of what goes on here. For the best souls have a sense that this is so, while the most corrupt deny it, and the divinations of godlike men carry more authority than those of lesser men. I think, for my part, that the men of former times, concerning whom I speak, would have been very eager, if it were possible for them, to set right their own associations, so that better things might be said of them than are said now. This, then, is still within our power, God willing, if anything has not been done rightly in our past association, to set it right both in deed and in word. For I hold that concerning true philosophy, the reputation and account of it will be better if we conduct ourselves decently, and the opposite if we behave badly. And indeed, in giving our care to this, we could do nothing more pious, nor, by neglecting it, anything more impious. Now I will state how this ought to be done, and where justice in the matter lies. I came to Sicily with a reputation for surpassing others by far in philosophy, and I wanted, once in Syracuse, to have you as a witness to confirm this, so that philosophy might be honored by the general public too. But this turned out not to be a happy venture for me. I will not name the cause that most people would give, but rather this. You plainly did not fully trust me, but seemed to want somehow to send me away and summon others instead, and to inquire into what exactly my business was, suspicious of me, as it seemed to me, and there were many shouting about this, saying that you had come to despise me and were eager for other things. This much has been widely reported. What is right to do after all this, listen, so that I may also answer what you ask, how you and I ought to stand toward each other. If you have come to despise philosophy altogether, let it go. But if you have heard something better from someone else, or found it yourself, better than what came from me, honor that instead. But if what comes from me pleases you, then you must honor me above all. Now then, just as at the beginning, you take the lead and I will follow. For if I am honored by you, I will honor you in return, but if not, I will hold my peace. Moreover, if you honor me and take the lead in this, you will be seen as honoring philosophy, and the very fact that you examined the matter carefully will bring you great esteem among many as a lover of wisdom. But if I honor you while you do not honor me, I will seem to be admiring and chasing after wealth, and we both know that carries no fine name among anyone. To put it briefly, if you do the honoring, it is an ornament to us both. If I do, it is a reproach to us both. So much then for this matter. As for the little sphere, it is not in proper order. Archidamus will explain to you when he comes. And concerning that other matter, which is more precious and more divine than this, and which he must explain to you very carefully, the question you sent about, being at a loss over it. You say, according to what he reports, that you have not been given a sufficient demonstration about the nature of the first. I must speak to you in riddles, so that if anything should happen to this letter in the folds of sea or land, whoever reads it will not understand. It is this: around the king of all things everything exists, and everything is for his sake, and he is the cause of all that is good. And around a second, the things of a second order, and around a third, the things of a third order. The human soul, then, longs to learn what these things are, looking to what is akin to itself, of which nothing it possesses is adequate. Concerning the king and the things I have named, there is nothing of that kind. That is what the soul next asks. But what then is it? This, son of Dionysius and Doris, is the question that is the cause of all evils, or rather, the birth pang that arises over it in the soul. And unless someone rids himself of it, he will never truly attain the truth. You yourself once told me, in the garden under the laurels, that you had thought this out, and that it was your own discovery. And I said that if this really seemed so to you, you had freed me of a great deal of argument. But I said I had never met anyone else who had discovered this, and that my own great labor had gone into just this question. You perhaps had heard it from someone, or perhaps by some divine chance you had set out toward it, but then you failed to bind fast the proofs of it, as though holding it securely. Instead, it flits about for you, now one way, now another, around the mere appearance of the thing, when it is nothing of the kind. And this has happened not to you alone. Be assured that no one who first hears from me has any other experience than this at the start. Some free themselves from it only with much trouble, others with less, and hardly anyone with little. Given that this is how things stand, we have pretty much discovered, in my opinion, what you asked in your letter, how we ought to stand toward each other. For since you are testing these matters, both by consorting with others and comparing them against what others say, and also on their own merits, now, if the test is a true one, these things will take root in you, and you will become at home both with them and with us. How then will this come about, and everything I have said? You did well just now in sending Archedemus, and in the future, once he has come to you and reported what I have said, other difficulties will perhaps occur to you afterward. Send Archedemus back to me again, then, if you judge rightly, and he will make the journey and come back once more. And if you do this two or three times and test thoroughly what has been sent from me, I would be surprised if what now troubles you does not seem very different then from now. So take courage and act accordingly, for neither you nor Archedemus will ever conduct a finer or more God-pleasing traffic than this. Be careful, though, that this never falls into the hands of uneducated people. For in my opinion, there is nothing more laughable to the many when they hear of these things, nor, on the other hand, anything more wondrous and inspiring to those of good natural gifts. Spoken of again and again, and heard over many years, it is refined only with much labor, the way gold is purified. But hear the remarkable thing about it. There are people who have heard these things, quite a few of them, capable of learning, capable of remembering, and of judging them thoroughly after testing them every way. Men now old, who have heard them for no less than 30 years, and who say that what once seemed to them utterly unbelievable now appears most believable and clearest of all, while what once seemed most believable now appears the opposite. Bearing this in mind, then, be careful that you never come to regret having let out, unworthily, what you now hold. The greatest safeguard is not to write it down, but to learn it by heart, for it is not possible for what is written not to leak out. That is why I myself have never writ anything on these matters, and there is no treatise by Plato, nor will there ever be. What is now called by his name belongs to a Socrates grown young and fair. Farewell and heed me, and after reading this letter now, many times over, burn it. So much for that. As for Polyxenus, you were surprised that I sent him to you, but about Lycophron too and the others in your court, I have said the same thing all along and say it now. In the practice of dialectical discussion, both by nature and by method of argument, you far surpass them all, and none of them is refuted willingly, as some suppose, but against their will. And you seem, indeed, to have handled and rewarded them quite fairly. So much on that score, said at some length given the subject. As for Philistion, if you yourself have use for him, make full use of him. But if it can be managed, lend him to Speusippus and send him over. Speusippus needs you too. And Philistion has promised me that, if you release him, he will come eagerly to Athens. You did well to release the man from the quarries. Your request about his household, and about Hegesippus son of Ariston, is a small thing to grant. You wrote to me that if anyone wrongs either him or them and you learn of it, you will not allow it to stand. And it is worth telling the truth about Lysicles. Alone among those who came back to Athens from Sicily, he has never changed his account of the time you and I spent together. He keeps speaking well of it, and puts the best face on what happened. Plato to Dionysius, greetings, or would I hit the mark better if, following my own custom, I wrote do well, the way I usually greet friends in my letters? For you, as those who were on pilgrimage at the time reported, addressed even the god at Delphi with that very flattering phrase, and wrote, so they say, greetings, and keep living the pleasant life of a tyrant. I would not urge even a human being to do that, let alone a god, not a god, because I would be commanding something against nature, since the divine is set apart from both pleasure and pain, and not a human being either, because pleasure and pain mostly breed harm, producing in the soul dullness, forgetfulness, folly, and arrogance. Let that be my word on the greeting. Read it and take it however you like. Not a few people say you tell some of the envoys who visit you that once, when you were speaking of your intention to resettle the Greek cities in Sicily and lighten the burdens on the Syracusans by turning your rule from tyranny into kingship. I heard you and talked you out of it, even though you were, as you say, eager to do it, and that now I am teaching Dion to do these very things, and that through your own ideas we are stripping you of your rule. Whether you gain anything from talking this way, you know best yourself. But you certainly wrong me by saying the opposite of what actually happened. I have already been thoroughly slandered to the mercenaries and to the mass of the Syracusans by Philistides and many others, on the grounds that I stayed on in the citadel, and that whenever anything went wrong, the outsiders blamed it all on me, claiming that you did everything I told you to. But you yourself know perfectly well that of all political matters, I willingly took part with you in only a few, and that at the start, when I thought I might accomplish something more, a few small things, and I gave modest attention to the preambles to the laws, apart from whatever you or someone else added afterward, for I hear that some of you later reworked them. In any case, both versions will be plain to anyone able to judge my style. But as I just said, I do not need to defend myself against slander before the Syracusans, or before whoever else you persuade by repeating this story. I need far more to defend myself against the earlier slander, and against this new one now growing bigger and fiercer than the first. I must make my defense on two counts. First, that I was right to avoid sharing in the city's affairs with you, and second, that this counsel, or this obstruction, which you say I gave when you meant to found Greek cities, was never mine. Hear first, then, the beginning of what I have to say about the first point. I came to Syracuse summoned by you and by Dion, a man I had already tested, and who had long been my guest friend, at a settled middle age. Exactly the kind of man needed by anyone with even a little sense who was about to deliberate on matters as weighty as yours were then. You, on the other hand, were very young, with a great deal of inexperience in the things you needed to have already mastered, and you were quite unknown to me. After that, whether it was a man, a god, or some stroke of fortune, Dion was driven out along with you, and you were left alone. Do you think, then, that I could at that point have shared political affairs with you, having lost my sensible partner, and seeing the senseless one left behind among many worthless men, not ruling but thinking he ruled, while actually ruled by such men? In these circumstances, what was I to do? Was it not necessary, as I in fact did, to let political matters go from then on, being wary of the slanders born of envy, and instead to try, though the two of you had become estranged and were at odds, to make you as much friends to each other as I possibly could? Of this you yourself are witness, that I never once slackened in pressing exactly that. And with difficulty, but still, we came to an agreement, that I would sail home, since war held you both back, but that once peace came, Dion and I would return to Syracuse, and you would summon us. That is how things stood regarding my first journey to Syracuse, and my safe return home. But the second time, once peace had come, you did not summon me according to our agreement. You wrote asking me alone to come, and said you would send for Dion later. Because of this, I did not go, and I even fell out of favor with Dion over it, since he thought it better for me to go and comply with you. After that, a year later, a trireme arrived along with letters from you, and the letters began by saying that if I came, all of Dion's affairs would go exactly as I wished, but if I did not come, the opposite. I am ashamed to say how many letters came at that time, from you and from others because of you, out of Italy and Sicily, and from how many of my own household and acquaintances, all urging me to go and begging me by all means to obey you. It seemed to everyone, starting with Dion, that I ought to sail and not be soft about it. And yet I pointed out my age to them, and I insisted about you that you would not be able to hold out against those slandering us and wanting us at odds. For I saw then, and I see now, that great and overgrown fortunes, whether of private men or of monarchs, nourish all the more, the greater they are, slanderers in ever greater numbers, men who deal in pleasure joined with shameful harm, than which wealth and the power that comes with unchecked authority breed no greater evil. Nevertheless, I let all this go and came, reasoning that none of my friends should be able to blame me for their ruin, when it might have been avoided, because of my own laziness. And once I arrived, for you know everything that happened from that point on, I expected, of course, according to what the letters had promised, that you would first bring Dion home and restore our friendship, explaining that closeness which, had you trusted me in it then, things might well have turned out better than they have for you, for Syracuse, and for the rest of the Greeks, or so my judgment foretells. Next, I expected that Dion's household would keep his property, and that those who had divided it among themselves, men you know well, would not keep the division. Beyond this, I thought that the yearly income he was accustomed to receive should be sent to him, and even more generously now that I was there, not less. Getting none of this, I asked to leave. After that, you persuaded me to stay the year, saying that you would sell off all of Dion's property and send half of it to Corinth, leaving the rest for his son here. There is much I could say about promises you made and never kept, but I will cut it short given how many there are. For after selling all the property, without persuading Dion, though you had said you would not sell without his consent, you capped off, my astonishing friend, all your promises with the boldest stroke of all. You devised a scheme, neither honorable nor clever nor just nor useful, meant to frighten me into thinking I was ignorant of what was then going on, so that I would not even ask that the money be sent. For when you drove out Heracles, an act neither the Syracusans nor I thought just, since together with Theodotes and Eurybius I had begged you not to do it, you seized on this as a sufficient pretext, and said that you had long seen through me, that I cared nothing for you, only for Dion and Dion's friends and household, and that since Theodotes and Heracles, being Dion's kin, were now under attack, I was scheming every way I could to keep them from paying the penalty. So much, then, for our political partnership, yours and mine. And if you saw any other estrangement growing in me toward you, you naturally suppose all of it came from this. Do not be surprised. I would rightly look base to any man of sense, if, swayed by the greatness of your power, I had betrayed an old friend and guest friend suffering harm because of you, a man no worse than you, if I may put it that way, and had instead chosen you, the wrongdoer, and done whatever you commanded, plainly for the sake of money. For no one could claim any other cause for my change of heart, had I changed. But this is how things happened, and it is because of you that this wolfish counterfeit of friendship, this failure of partnership between us, came about. This brings my account, almost without a break, to the very point I said I still had to defend myself on. Look closely now, and pay full attention, in case I seem to you to be lying anywhere and not telling the truth. I say that you, in the presence of Archedemus and Aristocritus in the garden, about 20 days before I sailed home from Syracuse, said the very things you now charge me with, that I cared more for Heracles and everyone else than for you. And in front of these same men, you asked me whether I remembered, from when I first arrived, urging you to resettle the Greek cities. I agreed that I remembered, and that I still think this the best course now. But I must also report, Dionysius, what was said next on that occasion. I asked you whether that was the only advice I was giving you, or something else besides, and you answered me, very angrily and, as you thought, quite scornfully. Which is why that insult of yours has now turned from a dream into a waking reality. You said, laughing in a very put-on way, if I remember, that you told me to do all this, or not do it, only once I had been properly educated. I said you remembered perfectly. Educated in geometry, you mean. You said. What I meant to say next I did not say, afraid that for the sake of one small remark my voyage home, which I was expecting, might narrow instead of opening wide before me. But the whole point of saying all this is just this. Do not slander me by claiming I was the one who forbade you to resettle the Greek cities being ravaged by barbarians, or to relieve the Syracusans by turning tyranny into kingship. You could never truthfully charge me with anything less fitting to me than this. And beyond that, I could offer even clearer proof, should any adequate tribunal ever appear, that I urged these very things, and you were the one unwilling to carry them out. And indeed it is not hard to state plainly that these things, had they been carried out, would have been the best course for you, for Syracuse, and for all Sicily. But my good man, if you deny having said what you did say, I have my case. And if you admit it, then, thinking Stesichorus wise for what came after, imitate his recantation, and turn from falsehood back to the true account. Plato to Dion of Syracuse, greetings. I think it has been clear the whole time how eager I was about the affairs that have come to pass, and how much effort I put into seeing them through to completion, for no reason more than my love of honor in noble things. For I hold it just that people who are truly good and act accordingly should meet with the reputation that fits them. As for the present, then, thank God, things stand well. But as for what is to come, the greatest struggle still lies ahead. For in courage and speed and strength, other people too might be thought to excel. But in truthfulness and justice and magnanimity, and in the good bearing that goes with all these, one would agree that those who lay claim to such things are rightly set apart from the rest. Now what I mean is obvious, but still we must remind ourselves that it is fitting for us to stand apart from other men, more than grown men stand apart from children, men you surely know whom I mean. We must show ourselves to be exactly what we claim to be, especially since, God willing, it will be easy. For it has fallen to other men of necessity to wander over much ground if they are to become known. But your situation now is such that people from the entire inhabited world, if it is not too bold to say, are looking toward a single place, and within that place, above all, toward you. So, since you are watched by everyone, prepare to make that old Lycurgus look ancient news, and Cyrus too, and anyone else who has ever seemed to excel in character and statesmanship. Especially since many, indeed almost everyone here, say there is a strong likelihood that once Dionysius is removed, the whole business will collapse on account of your rivalry for honor, and Heracles and Theodotes and the other associates. Above all, then, let there be no such man, but if one should arise after all, show yourself as one who heals him, and you would arrive at the best outcome. Perhaps this seems laughable to you, that I should say it, since you yourself are not ignorant of it. But I see even in the theaters how competitors are spurred on by children, let alone by friends whom one supposes to be urging them on earnestly out of goodwill. So now, carry on the contest yourselves, and if you need anything from us, write. Things here are much as they were when you were present. Write also about what has been accomplished by you, or what you happen to be doing, since we hear a great deal and know nothing. Even now letters have arrived from Theodotes and Heracles at Sparta and Aegina, while we, as I said, hear a great deal about affairs there and know nothing. Bear in mind, too, that some think you fall somewhat short of the attentiveness that is called for. Do not let it escape you that action itself depends in part on pleasing people, while self-will keeps company with isolation. Farewell. Plato to Perdiccas, greetings. I advised Euphrius, as you instructed, to spend his time attending to your affairs. And it is right that I should give you as well the counsel that is called guest counsel and sacred counsel, both about the other matters you may put to me and about how Euphrius ought to be employed just now. The man is useful in many ways, but the greatest is in the very thing you now lack, both because of your age and because young men do not have many advisors on this subject. There is, in fact, a kind of voice belonging to each form of government, as if to different living creatures, one voice for democracy, another for oligarchy, and yet another for monarchy. Very many people would claim to understand these voices, but apart from a few, they fall far short of actually grasping them. Whichever government speaks its own proper voice toward gods and men, and makes its actions follow that voice, always flourishes and is preserved, but if it imitates another, it is destroyed. In view of this, then, Euphrius could prove especially useful to you, capable as he also is in other matters. For I expect that he, of all the men occupied with your pursuits, will be particularly able to help work out the reasoning proper to monarchy. If you make use of him for this, then, you will benefit yourself and be of the greatest help to him as well. But if someone, hearing this, should say, Plato, it seems, pretends to know what benefits a democracy, yet though he had the chance to speak in the assembly and give it the best advice, he never once stood up and spoke. To this, one should reply that Plato came late to his own city and found the people already grown old and accustomed by earlier leaders to acting in many ways quite unlike his advice. Since he would have been glad, above all things, to advise it as a father would, had he not thought he would risk it in vain and accomplish nothing further. And I think my own advice would fare the very same way. For if we should seem incurable, one might bid us a hearty farewell and have nothing further to do with advising me or my affairs. Farewell. Plato to Hermias and Erastus and Coriscus, greetings. It seems to me that some god is preparing a good fortune for you, if you receive it well, kindly, and amply. For you live as neighbors to one another and have need of each other for the greatest benefits. For Hermias, no abundance of horses nor any other alliance in war, nor even an increase of gold, could give him greater power for everything than friends who are steadfast and of sound character. While for Erastus and Coriscus, beyond that fine wisdom about the forms, I say, old man that I am, they need in addition a wisdom that guards against wicked and unjust men, and some power of defense. For they are inexperienced in this, having spent so much of their lives with us, who are moderate and not wicked men. That is why I said they need these things, so that they may not be forced to neglect true wisdom while attending more than they should to the human and necessary kind. This latter power, it seems to me, Hermias has acquired partly by nature, in matters he has not yet had experience of, and partly by skill through experience. What then am I saying? To you, Hermias, who have had more experience of Erastus and Coriscus than they of you, I say and declare and bear witness that you will not easily find characters more trustworthy than these neighbors of yours. I advise you, then, by every just means to hold fast to these men, not counting it a side matter. And to Coriscus and Erastus in turn, I advise holding fast to Hermias, and trying, by holding fast to one another, to arrive at a single web of friendship. And if any of you should ever seem to be loosening this bond, for human affairs are never wholly secure, send here to me and my circle a letter accusing the fault. For I think that words coming from us here, framed with justice and respect, would be more likely than any incantation to knit and bind you back together into your former friendship and fellowship, provided whatever was undone has not turned out to be something great. If all of us, both we and you, practice philosophy, each as far as he is able and as circumstance allows, then what has just been prophesied will hold true. But what will happen if we do not do this, I will not say, for I foresee a good outcome, and I say that we shall make all these things turn out well, if God is willing. This letter all three of you must read, best of all together, but if not, then two at a time, sharing it as far as possible as often as you can, and you must treat it as a covenant and binding law, which is just, swearing by that God who is the leader of all things that are and are to be, and by the Lord and Father of that leader and cause, whom, if we truly practice philosophy, we shall all come to know clearly, so far as is possible for happy men. Plato to the household and companions of Dion, greetings. You wrote to me that I ought to consider your purpose the same as Dion's, and indeed you urged me to share in it, so far as I am able, in deed and in word. As for me, if you truly hold the same judgment and desire that he held, I agree to share in it. But if not, I shall have to deliberate many times over. What his judgment and desire were, I could tell you not by conjecture, but as one who knows clearly. For when I first arrived at Syracuse, being about 40 years old, Dion was of the age Hipparinus is now. And the conviction he held then, he kept holding to the end, that the Syracusans ought to be free, living under the best laws. So it is no wonder if some god should also bring this young man to share the same conviction about government as that man held. What the manner of its coming about was is not unworthy of being heard by young and old alike, and I will try to relate it to you from the beginning, for now is the fitting occasion. When I was young, I once felt what many feel. I thought that as soon as I became my own master, I would go straight into the public affairs of the city. And certain turns of the city's fortunes happened to fall out for me in this way. The constitution then in place was denounced by many, and a change came about. And of this change, 51 men took the lead as rulers, 11 in the city and 10 in the Piraeus, each group in charge of the market and whatever needed managing in the towns, while 30 were established as rulers over everything with absolute power. Some of these happened to be relatives and acquaintances of mine. And indeed, they invited me at once to join them, as if this were fitting work for me. And I felt nothing surprising for a young man. I thought they would manage the city by leading it from some unjust way of life to a just manner, so that I attended closely to what they would do. And watching these men, in a short time, make the previous government look like gold by comparison. Among other things, they sent an older friend of mine, Socrates, whom I would hardly be ashamed to call the most just man of that time, along with others, after one of the citizens, to bring him by force to be put to death, so that he might be made complicit in their affairs whether he wished it or not. He would not be persuaded, and risked suffering anything rather than become a partner in their unholy acts. Seeing all this, and other things of the sort no less serious, I was disgusted and withdrew myself from the evils of that time. Not long after, the rule of the 30 fell, and with it that whole government. And again, though more slowly, the desire to engage in public and political affairs drew me back. There were, even in that troubled time, many things happening that one might be disgusted by, and it was no wonder that in the upheavals some took harsher vengeance on certain enemies than was fitting, though those who returned then, in fact, showed a great deal of moderation. But by some chance, certain men in power brought our companion Socrates here into court, laying against him a most unholy charge, and one that suited Socrates least of all men. Some brought the charge of impiety, others voted to condemn, and they put to death the very man who, at the time of that unholy summons, had refused to take part in bringing in one of the friends then in exile, when those exiles were themselves suffering misfortune. As I considered these things, and the men engaged in public affairs, and the laws and customs too, the more I examined them and the further I advanced in age, the harder it appeared to me to manage public affairs rightly. For it was not possible to act without trusted friends and companions, and these were not easy to find ready-made, since our city was no longer governed by the customs and practices of our fathers, while to acquire new ones was impossible with any ease, and the very letter of the laws and customs was being corrupted and was worsening at an astonishing rate, so that I, who at first had been full of eagerness to engage in public affairs, when I looked at all this and saw things being swept along every which way, ended up growing dizzy. And while I never stopped examining whether some better course might emerge, both on these very points and on the whole matter of government, I kept holding off from actually doing anything, always waiting for the right occasion, until in the end I realized that all the cities of today are badly governed, every one of them. The state of their laws is nearly incurable without some extraordinary combination of preparation and luck. So I was forced to say, in praise of true philosophy, that only from it can one see clearly what is just, both in politics and in private life, and that the human race will not stop suffering evils until either the class of those who philosophize rightly and truly comes into political power, or those who hold power in cities come, by some divine allotment, to practice philosophy in earnest. Holding this conviction, I went to Italy and Sicily when I first arrived there. And once there, the life called happy in that country did not please me in the least. A life stuffed with Italian and Syracusan tables, filled twice a day, never sleeping alone at night, and all the other habits that go along with such a life. No one raised from youth in these practices could ever become wise, however remarkable his nature. Such a mixture would not permit it, nor could he ever come close to being temperate, and the same holds for the rest of virtue as well. No city could ever be at peace under its laws if its people think they must spend everything to excess, and then, once done, believe they should do nothing at all except toil away at feasts, drinking bouts, and the pursuit of sex. Such cities are bound to keep cycling endlessly through tyrannies, oligarchies, and democracies, and those who hold power in them will never so much as tolerate hearing the name of a just and equal constitution. With these thoughts added to what I already believed, I crossed over to Syracuse. By chance, perhaps, though it looks now as though some higher power was then setting in motion the beginning of everything that has since happened concerning Dion and the affairs of Syracuse. And I fear there may be still more to come, unless you now listen to me, as you did not the first time I gave you advice. How, then, do I claim that my arrival in Sicily at that time was the beginning of it all? When I spent time with Dion, who was young then, and explained to him in discussion what seemed to me the best things for people, urging him to put them into practice. I failed, I think, to notice that I was in effect engineering the overthrow of a tyranny without realizing it myself. Dion, being remarkably quick to learn, both in general and especially in response to the arguments I made at that time, took to them so eagerly and so thoroughly that no young man I had ever met came close. And he chose to live the rest of his life differently from most Italians and Sicilians, having come to value virtue more highly than pleasure and every other luxury. Because of this, he lived a life more burdensome to those who followed the ways of tyranny, right up to the death of Dionysius the Elder. After that, he came to think that this conviction, which he himself had come to hold through right argument, should not remain in him alone. He noticed it arising in others too, not many, but some. And he judged that Dionysius the Younger might, with the gods' help, become one of them. And if that came about, he believed his own life and the lives of all the Syracusans would turn out to be blessed beyond measure. Beyond this, he thought it essential that I come to Syracuse as quickly as possible by any means, to share in the work, remembering how easily our own time together had brought him to desire the finest and best kind of life. If he could accomplish the same thing now in Dionysius, as he was attempting, he had great hopes of establishing a happy and genuinely good life throughout the whole country, without bloodshed, deaths, or the evils that have now occurred. Reasoning rightly along these lines, Dion persuaded Dionysius to send for me, and he himself begged me, in letter after letter, to come as quickly as possible by any means, before others could get to Dionysius and turn him toward some other, lesser life. His plea, to put it briefly, though it deserves a longer account, ran like this. "What greater occasion," he said, "could we ever wait for than the one now placed before us by some divine stroke of fortune?" He went through the extent of his power in Italy and Sicily, and his own influence within it, the youth of Dionysius, and how strong his enthusiasm was, he said, for philosophy and education. He pointed out that his own nephews and relatives could easily be won over to the kind of life and argument I always spoke of, and were most capable of drawing Dionysius in as well, so that if ever there was hope of philosophers and the rulers of great cities turning out to be one and the same people, it was now. These were his appeals, and many others like them in great number. As for my own judgment, I had real fear about how things would turn out with these young men. The desires of people like that move quickly and often pull against themselves. But I knew Dion's character, that his soul was by nature steady and already at a reasonably mature age. So as I waited, uncertain whether I should go and comply or not, I nonetheless came down on the side that if anyone was ever going to try to carry out in practice what had been thought through about laws and government, now was the time to attempt it. If I could persuade just this one man thoroughly, I would have achieved everything good. With this reasoning and this resolve, I set out from home, not for the reasons some imagined, but chiefly out of shame before myself, for fear I might seem to myself to be nothing but words, a man who would never willingly lay a hand to any deed, and that I might risk betraying, first of all, my bond of guest friendship and comradeship with Dion, who was truly in no small danger. Suppose he had suffered some harm, or been driven out by Dionysius and his other enemies, and come to us as a fugitive, and asked, "Plato, I have come to you in exile, not because I need hoplites or cavalry to fight off my enemies, but because I need words and persuasion. The very things you, I knew better than anyone, were able to use to turn young men toward the good and the just, and toward friendship and fellowship with one another. It is for want of these, on your part, that I now leave Syracuse behind and stand here. My own disgrace matters less to you, but philosophy, which you are always praising, and which you say is treated with contempt by the rest of humankind, has it not now been betrayed, so far as it depended on you, along with me? And if we had happened to be living in Megara, you would surely have come to help me in what I asked, or you would have thought yourself the most worthless of men. But now, do you imagine that by pointing to the length of the journey and the size of the voyage and the effort involved, you will ever escape the reputation of cowardice? Far from it. Had such things been said to me, what dignified answer could I have given? None. So I went, and reasonably so, and as justly as a man possibly could, abandoning my own pursuits here, which were not without honor, to place myself under a tyranny that seemed unfitting both for what I taught and for me. By going, I freed myself in the eyes of Zeus, guardian of guests, and kept the calling of philosophy free of reproach. Reproach it would have deserved had I grown soft and, out of cowardice, taken on some share of shame. And once there is no need to draw this out. I found everything around Dionysius full of factional strife and slander directed at Dion before the tyrant. I defended him as far as I was able, though I could do little. And after about the fourth month, Dionysius, accusing Dion of plotting against his rule, put him on a small boat and threw him out in disgrace. After that, all of us who were Dion's friends were afraid that he might accuse one of us in turn and punish us as accomplices in Dion's supposed plot. A rumor even went around Syracuse that I had been put to death by Dionysius as the cause of everything that had happened. Dionysius, noticing all of us in this state of alarm and fearing something worse might come of our fear, took everyone back in a friendly manner. He reassured me in particular, urged me to take heart, and pleaded with me to stay in every way, since it did him no good at all for me to flee from him, whereas my staying, this is exactly why he made such a show of pleading. We know that the pleading of tyrants is mixed with compulsion, and it was by contriving just this that he kept me from sailing away, bringing me instead up to the citadel and settling me there, from which no ship's captain could have taken me out, not even if Dionysius had not been actively blocking it, let alone against his wishes. No, not even if he himself had sent orders that whoever wished should take me away. No merchant, and none of the officials stationed at the country's points of departure, would have let me pass through alone without seizing me at once and bringing me straight back to Dionysius. Especially since word had already gone round, quite the opposite of what it had been before, that Dionysius was showing me remarkable favor. And what was the truth of it? I must tell it plainly. His favor did grow, as time went on, more from our being together and coming to know each other's character and temper. But he wanted me to praise him rather than Dion, and to regard him as a friend far more than Dion, and he competed for this with remarkable eagerness. Yet the one way this could have come about most honorably, if it was going to come about at all, by learning and listening to arguments about philosophy and growing close to me through them. This he shrank from, afraid of what his slanderers were saying, lest he be hindered somehow and Dion's whole plan be brought to completion. I endured all of it, holding to the same purpose I had come with, in the hope that he might somehow come to desire the philosophically life, but he won out against me in his resistance. And so the first period of my residence and stay in Sicily came about, for all these reasons. After that I went abroad and came back again, at Dionysius's urgent and repeated summons. Why I did so, and all that I did, as being reasonable and just, I will explain later, once I have first advised you on what must be done given what has now happened. This for the sake of those who keep asking what I wanted in coming a second time, so that these secondary matters do not get treated by me as if they were the main business. So here is what I say. To a man who is ill and living on a harmful regimen, an adviser must first tell him, above all, to change his way of life. If he is willing to listen, one may then go on to give the rest of the advice. But if he is not, I would consider a man who walks away from giving such advice to be a real man and a true physician, and one who stays and keeps giving it to be no man at all, and no craftsman. The same holds for a city too, whether it has one ruler or many. If the government, moving along a right and proper path, asks advice on some fitting matter, then it is the mark of good sense to give that advice. As for those who step entirely outside the right kind of constitution and are unwilling to set even a foot on its path, but instruct their adviser to leave the constitution alone and not disturb it, on pain of death if he does, and bid him instead serve their wishes and desires, and advise them how these might come about most easily and quickly and last forever, such a man, if he complies with advice of that sort, I would consider unmanly. While the one who refuses to comply, I would call a real man. Holding this view myself, Whenever someone consults me about some matter of real importance concerning his own life, say, the acquiring of money, or the care of his body or soul. If it seems to me that he lives his daily life in some reasonable way, or that he would be willing to follow advice about the things he brings to me, I give my advice eagerly and don't stop merely to satisfy some formal obligation. But if he doesn't consult me at all, or if it's clear that he won't follow my advice in any way, I don't go to such a person uninvited to offer counsel, and I certainly wouldn't force it on him, even if he were my own son. To a slave, I might give advice, and even press it on him against his will. But a father or mother, I don't think it right to coerce, unless they're gripped by some disease of madness. If they're living according to some settled way of life that pleases them, but not me, I shouldn't alienate them by pointless scolding, nor yet should I flatter them and serve their wants by supplying satisfactions for desires which, embracing them myself, I wouldn't want to live by. In just the same way, a sensible man ought to think and live regarding his own city. He should speak up, if the way it's governed doesn't seem good to him, provided he isn't going to speak in vain or get himself killed for speaking. But he shouldn't use force on his fatherland to bring about a change of constitution when the best one cannot come about without banishing and slaughtering men. Rather, he should keep quiet and pray for good things, both for himself and for the city. This, then, is the manner in which I would advise you, and in which Dion and I advise Dionysius as well. To live one's daily life, first of all, so as to become as much as possible master of oneself, and to acquire trustworthy friends and companions, so that he might not suffer what his father suffered. Who, having taken over many large cities of Sicily that had been devastated by the barbarians, was unable to resettle them and establish in each a government of loyal companions. Not from anywhere among strangers, nor even from brothers whom he himself had raised from boyhood, whom he had made rulers out of private citizens and rich men out of poor ones. Of these he could win over not a single one to a genuine share in his rule, by persuasion, teaching, favors, or kinship. And so he turned out 7 times worse than Darius, who, trusting not brothers whom he himself had raised, but only men who had shared with him in overthrowing the Mede and the eunuch, divided all of Sicily's equivalent into 7 parts, each larger than any single share, and used these partners as trustworthy men who did not attack either him or one another, and showed the model of what a good lawgiver and king ought to be. For by establishing laws, he has preserved the Persian Empire even to this day. Consider further the Athenians. They did not found the many Greek cities they took over, cities already invaded by barbarians but still inhabited. Yet they preserved their empire for 70 years by having friendly men in each of those cities. But Dionysius, having gathered all Sicily into one city and trusting no one out of his own so-called cleverness, barely survived. For he was poor in loyal, trustworthy friends, and there is no greater sign of virtue or vice than whether a man has such friends or lacks them. This is exactly what Dion and I advised Dionysius, since, given how things had turned out for him through his father, he had grown up without any contact with education and without the fellowship proper to his station. Our first advice, having started from this point, was that he should acquire other friends among his own kin and age mates who were in harmony with him regarding virtue, and above all that he should become a friend to himself. For in this respect, he was astonishingly lacking. We did not put it so plainly, since that would not have been safe, but we hinted at it, arguing that in this way every man would save both himself and those he came to lead, while turning away from this path he would bring about the opposite of everything. And if he went the way we described, and made himself a man of sense and self-control, then were he to resettle the depopulated cities of Sicily, and bind them together with laws and constitutions, so that they were loyal to him and to one another against the incursions of the barbarians, he would not merely double his father's empire, but multiply it many times over. For once this had been achieved, it would be entirely possible to enslave the Carthaginians far more thoroughly than they had been enslaved after the time of Jelen, rather than, as things now stand, having his own father agree to pay them tribute. These were the words we spoke and the counsel we pressed, we who were plotting against Dionysius, as such talk was reported to have spread from many quarters, talk which, once it gained the upper hand with Dionysius, led to Dion's banishment and threw us into fear. But to compress into a short space matters that took no short time to unfold. Dion came from the Peloponnese and Athens and admonished Dionysius through actual deeds. And once he had freed the city and restored it to the Syracusans twice over, they then treated Dion just as Dionysius had treated him, at the very time he was trying, by educating and raising him, to make him a king worthy of the office and to share with him his whole life. But those who slandered Dion, saying that in doing everything he did at that time he was plotting for the tyranny, made it so that Dionysius, bewitched in mind by education, would neglect his rule and hand it over to Dion, while Dion would seize it for himself and drive Dionysius from power by trickery. This slander won out then, and a second time among the Syracusans, in a victory both strange and shameful for those responsible for it. Those who now call on me regarding the present situation must hear how it happened. I came, an Athenian, a companion of Dion and his ally, to the tyrant, so as to bring about friendship in place of war. But struggling against the slanderers, I was defeated. When Dionysius tried, with honors and money, to make me his own, so that I might serve as witness and friend lending respectability to Dion's banishment, he failed entirely in this. Later, when Dion returned home, he took on two brothers from Athens, friends made not through philosophy, but through that circle of so-called companionship most people have, which men cultivate by playing host and by initiating and being initiated into mysteries. And indeed these two, who had helped bring him home, became his companions out of the circle and out of the service they rendered toward his return. When they came to Sicily, once they perceived that Dion had been slandered among the Sicilians he had freed as plotting to become tyrant, they not only betrayed their companion and guest friend, but became virtually the murderers themselves, standing armed alongside the actual killers as their accomplices. As for the shameful and impious act itself, I neither pass over it nor say anything more about it, for many others make it their business to sing of these things, and will continue to do so in time to come. But I do want to lift from the Athenians the charge people bring against them, that these two men brought shame on the city. For I say that the other man too was an Athenian, the one who did not betray this same Dion, though he could have taken money and many other honors. He had not become Dion's friend through some vulgar attachment, but through a partnership rooted in a free education. And it is this alone that a man of sense ought to trust, rather than kinship of body and soul. So the two who killed Dion did not become worthy of reproach to the city, as though they had ever been men of any account. All this has been said for the sake of advising Dion's friends and kinsmen. And I have some further advice to add to this, speaking now for the third time to you three the same counsel and the same argument. Do not enslave Sicily or any other city to human masters, that is my advice, but to laws. For it is better for neither the enslavers nor the enslaved, for themselves and for their children's children and their descendants. The attempt is utterly ruinous, and it is the mark of small and unfree souls to be fond of snatching such gains, men who know nothing of what is good and just, whether for the future or the present moment, in matters divine or human. These are the things I first attempted to persuade Dion of, second Dionysius, and now third you. And do listen to me, for the sake of Zeus the Savior, third in the toast, and then look to Dionysius and Dion. Of these, the one who did not listen lives now dishonorably, while the one who did listen died honorably. For whatever a man suffers in reaching after the finest things, both for himself and for his city, is altogether right and good. For none of us is by nature immortal, and even if one of us should happen to be, he would not thereby be happy, as most people think. For nothing good or bad worth mentioning belongs to things without soul, but this will happen to each soul either while it is joined with a body or when separated from it. We must truly always trust the ancient and sacred accounts, which reveal to us that the soul is immortal and has judges and pays the greatest penalties whenever it is released from the body, Wherefore we ought to consider it a lesser evil to suffer great wrongs and injustices than to commit them. The man who loves money and is poor in soul neither listens to this, nor, if he does hear it, does he, laughing at it as he supposes, shamelessly snatch from every side whatever he thinks he can, like some beast, to eat or drink, or to provide himself, in that slavish and graceless business wrongly called the pleasure of Aphrodite, with satisfaction to the point of glutting himself, blind, and not seeing what impiety attends his plunder in every case, an evil that must always follow each act of wrongdoing, which the wrongdoer is forced to drag along with him, both while wandering above the earth and after returning beneath it, on a journey utterly dishonored and wretched in every way. It was by saying these and other such things that I tried to persuade Dion, and I would be perfectly justified in feeling anger, in some way quite similar, at both his killers and at Dionysius. For both, one might say, have done the greatest harm to me and to virtually everyone else. The killers, by destroying a man who wished to make use of justice, and Dionysius, by refusing throughout his whole reign to make any use of justice at all. Though he held the greatest power, in which, had philosophy and power truly come together in the same place, shining sufficiently through all mankind, both Greek and barbarian, it would have established in everyone the true belief that no city and no man could ever be happy who does not pass his life under justice together with wisdom, whether by possessing it in himself or by being nurtured and rightly educated under the rule of righteous men. This is the harm Dionysius did. All else would be small harm to me compared to this. But the man who killed Dion does not know that he has done the very same thing as Dionysius did. I know clearly as one human being can affirm anything about another, that if Dion had held power, he never would have turned it to any other shape of rule than this. First, he would have set Syracuse, his own homeland, shining and free, once he had cleared away her slavery. And then, once she stood established in freedom, he would have used every device to array her citizens under laws that were fitting and best of all. Next, he would have set his heart on settling all Sicily and freeing it from the barbarians, driving some out and subduing others more easily than Hieron had done. And with all this accomplished through a man just, brave, self-controlled, and philosophical, the same opinion about virtue would have taken hold among ordinary people that would have taken hold, had Dionysius been persuaded, and saved, one might almost say, the whole human race. But as it is, some divinity or some avenging spirit fell upon him with lawlessness, godlessness, and, worst of all, the reckless daring of ignorance, the root from which every evil takes hold in every soul and sprouts, and later brings forth for those who bred it the bitterest fruit, and the same thing overturned and destroyed everything a second time. Now, for the sake of a good omen, let us speak well of the third attempt. All the same, I advise you, his friends, to imitate Dion in his devotion to his homeland and in the disciplined way he lived, and, under better auspices, to try to bring to completion the things he wished for, and what those were you have heard clearly from me. Whoever among you cannot live in the Dorian manner, according to your ancestral ways, but instead pursues the life of Dion's murderers and the ordinary run of Sicilian living, him you should neither invite in nor suppose that he could ever do anything trustworthy or sound. The rest you should invite to join in settling and giving equal law to all Sicily, drawing on Sicily itself and on the whole of the Peloponnese together, and you need not fear even Athens. For there too are men who surpass all others in virtue, and who hate the reckless daring of those who murder their own guest friends. But if all this must wait until later, and the many, many kinds of civil strife springing up every day press hard upon you now, then every man to whom some divine fortune has granted even a small share of right judgment ought to know this. There is no rest from evils for those caught in civil strife, until the victors in the battles, the banishments, and the killings put an end to nursing their grudges and turning to vengeance against their enemies.